Hello and welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, episode 50.
Ish.
More on that later. A semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is entitled Fumbles, Revelations. And it's about, well, it's the name of a lovely little chapbook that's very losable and perhaps stealable, I guess, as well as the little moments in our lives that become poems. And we're going to talk about poetics, and who better to talk about poetics than of the 50-ish episodes of this podcast. I should make this clear. This is labeled episode 50. Somehow there were two 33s. And then there were two remix episodes because my sound engineering skills got better. So it's either episode 49, 50, or 51. But we're calling it 50. And damn it, you need to be happy for us in this very fake...
Milestone?
Milestone that we've Monument. Gotten. Thank you. Yes. But anyway, the person, guest, four-time guest, author of Fumbles Revelations... What is your role with the Bridge series? How do you even call... What do we call that?
Because you're not on the board. I am on the board of directors and co-organizer, I suppose.
Co-organizer of the Bridge series and host. Gadfly, man about town, self-proclaimed Huguenot. Jason Baldinger. Hello. Welcome.
Hey, Matt.
Thank you for coming back.
Anytime, doing this brother, thing I love doing
as
this.
We do.
I now realize that I'm almost up to 10%, so...
You got a book coming out in September.
Well,
so
you know, I might get episode 55 or so, you know,
yeah,
60, well, depending on how it goes.
Yeah, definitely not 60. I realize I'm averaging a little less than one a month. So,
okay, well,
so I would say 53 is ambitious.
Nice. Well, you know,
Silsby. Was what, 46 or 47 and 49?
Okay.
So
there's always,
you know, I have these nice unplanned 5-month hiatuses that you know,
life.
I go and imagine the vision, I reimagine again. I go hiking in Tibet and I think about this podcast
and get myself a Sherpa
and decide, you know, do I really understand it, man? You know, so Steve Jobs did the same thing.
I think.
Yeah. So, Fumbles Revelations, a tiny, cute little blue book.
First edition is blue. It could be a different color at some point in time.
First edition is blue. Could be a different color at some time.
For those of you who fetishize objects in such ways, you know.
Yeah.
It's blue now. It could be gray in the future.
Could be gray, could be white, could be canary yellow. Who knows?
You never know.
Chartreuse?
Probably not chartreuse. Probably I don't think Don Wentworth is a chartreuse kind of guy, but, you know.
But, so, I think this is a fascinating book, or kind of an interest. I want to say interest. That sounds bad. Oh, that was an interesting stylistic choice, Jason. But, I mean... And it's not really a departure either, because it's... See, now it's sounding like Lars when it was... Yeah, it was different, but it's like totally Metallica, man. You know? This is a different book, but it's totally Baldinger, man.
This is my Lulu book.
This is... Oh, no! It's not your Lulu book. It's...
Oh, thank fucking God it's not my Lulu book.
No, it is infinitely readable, yes. But it is... As much as, you know, the rest of your books are about moments.
Right.
And we had this conversation several months ago, and then about 30 minutes ago,
mm-hmm.
when you once said to me, for you, if it's a story you could tell, it becomes a poem. If it's an anecdote, it becomes a poem.
Mm-hmm.
The book itself is, and I'm grabbing the ruler here.
Three
and a half by four, or so. Four and a quarter. 3.5 by 4.25.
Which is considerably shorter than the other books, which are... Most of my other books are set to the same size as Ferland Getty's New Dimensions Press books.
5.25 by... Look at this one. We're measuring by 8.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's the same size as Coney Island of the Mind.
Exactly. What a wonderful book that is.
Right. That was the basis that I used. That's the blueprint. So this is the smallest.
This is great. But, you know, so, I mean, these poems are smaller.
They are much smaller. Yes, they are much smaller.
But, I mean, I think also as much as it is absolutely your well-developed, authentic, authorial voice,
mm-hmm.
That now you almost get these, I mean, snapshots, glimpses.
Well, that's
slight, like, moments, wisps, pangs of memory, however you want to call it.
That's an excellent point. So, basically, when I started reading out and performing poetry, 2009, 2010, give or take, I was lucky enough to get a chance to read with Don Wentworth, who's a local haiku and short form artist here in Pittsburgh. Bodhisattva, if you will. You know, he is his own Buddhist monk of sorts. And in reading with Don and listening to Don do what he does, you immediately want to figure out how to do that. You know? And I'm not going to be as good at the short form as a man who studied throughout the course of his life, who's now in his 60s. Don runs Lilliput Review, which posts books about this size. And so it was a goal of mine at that point in time to get a poem into Lilliput Review. So the one thing that I could think to do was to go to bars and strip away the entire story and just try and catch one moment in a bar. And that's the genesis of this book. What ultimately happened was after I got my poem, which is the first poem in the book, Riggs Lounge is accepted to Lilliput. I was in Kansas City with Don and a few other people with the Kansas City Throwdown, and the weekend was so intense with like over 60 poets reading and meeting people from all over the country and whatnot, that there was no way for me to write a poem about Kansas City and what happened. So instead, I just had a little notebook, and every time something kind of flashed, it was like, "Well, that's a poem," you know? So I came home from Kansas City on that Tuesday, and I wrote 17 poems. Whether they were things that I had seen over the weekend, I started working on finishing up another book and whatnot. And when, as we've gotten to this point in my existence as a writer, I now, as things are done, or I think they are done, I immediately try and send them out. You know, try and get them published somewhere, you know, because what good are they doing sitting on your laptop? You know, you're in between books, you know. I mean, somebody needs to look at this stuff, and if you get turned down, you get turned down. So it goes. Rejection happens as a poet.
Yes.
There's another place that will take it. I don't know why people get upset about it. I just look at it as, oh, okay, fair. So I sent 10 poems to Don for Lilliput to see if he wanted any of them. And I got an email back from him that said, "Hey, man, I really like these. I think I might be able to take like 3 or 4 of them. Let me sit on them a while and I'll get back to you." About a week later, I ran into him again and he said, "Do you have more?" I'm like, "Fuck yeah." So I went back and I found bar poems from previous that I had tried to do and whatnot, and I ended up sending him ultimately about 40 or 45 poems, nothing over 15 lines. And he came back to me with 15 poems. It's like, "If you want to do this, let's do this as a book together. I have this new project I'm looking to start. Let's do this." So this was a very fast and fluid. It took 1 month.
Wow.
From the first 10 poems that I sent to Don at the end of April to the point where the physical book was in my hand. Actually, probably less.
Wow.
You know, so, you know, I already got into Lilliput Review, but now I've sort of one-upped that dream by actually getting Don to put out a small book for me.
Is,
you know, even better in that regard. So, thank you to Don Wentworth.
Yeah, thank you to Don Wentworth. So, we talked about these style. Can we hear a couple of these poems?
Sure.
Do you mind
these
doing
are
a little,
all very
doing
short
a little
poems.
Reading for me? Maybe we'll do
sure.
A party pack combo or something?
How many would you like?
I don't care. It's your damn book. You don't want to give the whole thing away on the podcast.
You're right. You're
or
right.
If you want to do the Fumbles Revelations audiobook on the Good Enough.
I did already record the audiobook. It hasn't gone up yet. So, the audiobook is, I think, 4.5 minutes.
I love it.
This entire thing, really, it takes that little time. It could be a nice bathroom book for you. That sounded like salesmanship, you know?
I think that sounds like I said bathroom book for people who have a prune and whole grain heavy diet, I think.
Yes.
I need more time than this book allows.
Well, you can read it twice.
Or to read times. It twice, yeah.
I mean, I hope it doesn't get old. So we'll
it doesn't.
So we'll start then with the first poem. This came out of, Lilliput Review. This will also be in my book coming out in September called Fragments of a Rainy Season. This is a poem called Riggs Lounge, which is over on the north side. All it takes is a quarter. Flipped or tossed from anywhere in the bar into the tall, clear beer stein to the left of the register to open the doors to heaven. And we'll move on to... how about a drug poem?
Yes!
There we go. It's a poem called Mescaline.
Ah, I flipped that one too.
I was looking for the true image of God. Well, I found my face reflected in toilet water as I vomited. And another thought, reasons to hate being poor, and maybe some of you have been in this situation.
Mm-hmm.
The bar bathroom, an inch of piss on the floor, holes in both of my shoes. Oof. Let's move on, and we'll do one more, and then we'll talk about something else for a little while, or we'll do something. I don't know. This is called Mizzou. Basically overheard in a gas station, or overseen in a gas station. The cashier talks tattoos. The couple ahead buy two hot dogs and a sixer of Bud Light Lime. The woman grabs his ass. He pays with $100. Just a sampling.
Just a sampling. Lovely sampling. But, yeah... My mind immediately, of course, goes to cave paintings in France. Right?
I've never seen cave paintings in France. I have seen them in the West, in Albuquerque in the and West. Such places.
There's that great Werner Herzog documentary called...
Can't help you on this one, sorry.
Sorry, but it's really great. It's the one movie I regret not seeing in the theaters in 3D because it would have been worth the headache. But Cave of Forgotten Dreams. Cave of Forgotten Dreams. The idea being, of course, is that those cave paintings are the oldest known.
Right.
You know, and a lot of it is handprints. Mm-hmm. And this idea, you think of this handprint, you know, putting a handprint on a cave wall in France. I was here, I am somebody.
Right.
And thinking about your poetics in particular, and I was kind of checking out the other fine books, Studs Terkel Blues, The Lady of Pittsburgh, Whiskey Rebellion.
Right.
And The Lower 48. Which are all available. There'll be links on the pod to find them. All of those, this way of taking and preserving your experience. You know, at some point, the Fumbles Revelations will be floating out there forever, right? I mean, there'll
hopefully,
be
I mean,
at least one copy that survives into
you hope.
Perpetuity.
You hope. But, this maybe ties in to some extent. We were talking in... Cleveland when I read there a couple weeks ago with a Buffalo poet and a Jersey poet about how, and I don't know that anybody else has suggested this, that poetry is also social history in its own regard.
I like that a lot. Like that a lot.
You know, especially at this point in time in history where academia and the prestige of academia has fallen off to some extent and you now have small presses and anyone theoretically can get published.
Yeah.
So you have all these different people writing their experiences and writing about their life and writing directly about it. And it gives you a direct line into what poor people were doing at this point in time. And at no other point in time in history have more poor people been able to write this freely about themselves and what's going on in their lives. So for the first time, 200 years from now, people will be able to go, Jesus Christ, 2017 in America was a really strange place to be. You know? I mean, not that any time in America is not a strange place to be, or any time in the world. I mean, the improbability of the here and now immediately creates a surrealness to any moment. But this also then ties into what you were saying. If I can tell it as a story, I can write it as a poem, which is something I said as well.
Yeah, so that you said it first.
We're now at meta.
And you said it first. We've gone meta.
I'm quoting you, quoting me. So yes.
Yeah, that's weird. So that's like double quotation marks with the single quotation marks in single quotes, double quotes. Parenthetical reference, open parentheses, you see a podcast or whatever, you see a quote, QTD period Baldinger.
Yes.
Close parentheses period. That's how that
works. Wow. That footnote hurt my head, but okay, cool.
Sorry. That's MLA, even. That's not even a footnote. That is a parenthetical in-text citation according to the rules of the MLA Handbook 8th edition, which I'm slowly having to learn because
you have this project.
This is what my project and the silly thing I decided to try to do for a living.
Yeah, that's fair. Yes. I mean, that's what we're all here for, right?
Yes, absolutely. Which, you know, you're right. And thinking about social history, people's history, and, you know... Okay, let's talk about the America thing. Can we talk about America?
Sure.
We'll talk about America?
Yeah.
And talk about American poetics, or I think the American narrative.
Okay.
Because I think you're absolutely right. It's never not been a weird time to be an American.
It's true.
But, man, I don't know if you grew up with the Weekly Reader when Reagan was president.
No. I wasn't reading that at that point.
Yeah, we got that. We got the Weekly Reader in Ms. Trenchak's class. And, man, Ronald Reagan, Michael Jackson, and the Space Shuttle.
That's being a poem title in its own right there. I mean, if you want to, you're right.
Being American was fucking awesome.
Yeah,
well. We were the shining city on the hill. And granted, that was bullshit. And neoliberalism was taking over. And there was this violent reordering that was structurally violent. I won't say shooting with guns or whatever. But there was a violence to structural changes in our society that were happening at that time.
Right. And those,
but American exceptionalism, that was a fun myth. You gotta admit, that was a fun, it's like a failed relationship.
Right.
And it ended very badly and you had to like move, like change cities or something after it was over.
But somehow we are still holding on to those myths. You know, this is another
thing.
Some people are.
And I think for me, because I mean, yeah, there's no way Trump can win. There's no way. It's not going
to
happen.
But if you look at the media still continues to run those myths across the board. Those haven't changed in any way, shape, or form. Let me find. There's a poem here.
Okay.
That works for that. Hang on.
It works for that. No, that's okay. I'll pontificate while you shuffle
papers. It'll take like 30 seconds. Yeah. It's right here.
But yeah, no, I mean, that's... Oh, there he is. He's got it. I didn't even have to think of a smart point, which was good because I didn't have one. So here goes Jason, reading some more.
This was just published by Wine Drunk Sidewalk, my buddy John Grahalski.
Yes.
In New York, is turned his blog into a protest blog. And you submit poems about the American experience right now, and he publishes them, generally speaking. If he likes them, of course.
Yeah.
So this is a poem called The Hymn to the Greatest.
Yes. We talked about yes, this. I've been to that Walmart.
We've been to that Goodwill. Week.
Yes.
I pulled into the Goodwill, the one near the college, the one near the Walmart, the one across the street, or across the highway from the convenience store, the one down the highway from two more convenience stores, the one overlooking a nuclear power plant, the one where the incline to the Highlands starts. The car CD player is broken. I scan the dial on the radio and rest on the right-wing nut. The guy filling in for Savage. The guy whose anti-Muslim rhetoric is nauseating. The guy who says America is the greatest country in the world. And I wonder momentarily about the greatest country in the world. Is there a vote? A quarrel? Did a group of countries get together and sing He's a Jolly Good Fellow and then give us a wristwatch for our service? Talk about how they want to be great countries too. You should probably be suspicious of anyone who says that America is the greatest country. It isn't. And I don't know off my head that I would hand that award to any country. A country is as good as the people it contains. It is a reflection of the attitudes of those people. Is also wholly imaginary and man-made, like time, like God, like boundaries, like dreams. To ballyhoo is propaganda. It obfuscates the real conversation, the fact that to question, to challenge the normalcy of any government is patriotism. It is required for a country to be a proper reflection of its people. To say you're the greatest without proof, without basis, is to be like a spoiled child. And God forbid that we are a nation of spoiled children.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's sort of that thing. I mean, we've all grown up with... I actually still have some here. Thank you. You can have that. I'll use it later.
Yeah. Sorry.
Passing bottle openers.
Yeah, passing bottle openers of the podcast. Yeah, I mean, I think for me... You think of America as a powerful idea the way hell's a powerful idea, right? I mean, it forms, you know, and I think, you know, in my job, in my life, during, you know, 8 months out of the year, 9 months out of the year, watching young people trying, in some cases, very awkwardly to cram their lives into the mm-hmm. American dream narrative.
Right. The completely false American dream narrative.
Yeah, completely false American dream narrative, and it's not necessarily what people want, and the power of a story.
But you have these tropes and these narratives that run and string across like helixes and DNA through American life, whether it be America's the greatest country in the world. How many times growing up did you say something about America that wasn't popular?
The Weekly Reader was that it was there. It was the thing. But you're right. I mean, it's a hard thing for people to sort of liberate themselves from that idea.
Right. You know, it's a country that you're talking about. It's not your personal thing. I mean, it is because you're here and you're part of it. But simultaneously,
and you're responsible for it.
Right. But to sit there and say you're the greatest. Come on now. Really?
Really? That means you also don't have to do anything about it.
Yeah.
You don't have to. That's like so anti-political. It's like country music. It's anti-political political statements.
Right. It's like, oh, well, we're the greatest then. Shit.
We're good.
We're just going to sit here on our hands. We don't have to think about what's wrong or what isn't being done or who isn't covered under the umbrella of the greatest country in the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and the American dream is obviously, you know, a completely conflated idea in the same regard of that. You know, there is no Horatio Alger climb for most of us at this point in time.
Yeah.
It still works for a few people.
Still works for a few people. And you think about, too, and I think about, you know, those tropes about how millennials are killing Buffalo Wild Wings and millennials are killing the car industry and millennials are killing this. And, you know, you think about even the fact that maybe there's a generation of people that are right-sizing the dream.
Are starting to question the dream.
Are questioning the dream and saying, well, what if actually I just, you know, did this instead?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the thing that I bring up in class a lot, whenever we talk about or think about these issues, you know, if you were a man, not being sexist, it was the 50s, wage earners, male, whatever.
Yes. No,
and belonged to a union, the closing costs and down payment on a Levittown house was roughly 2 paychecks.
Yeah. That sounds about right. I mean, I've talked to people in the 60s, you know, when they lived in the 60s, it was, you know, if you worked 3 to 5 months a year, you pretty much covered your bills for the year. You didn't have to work all year. You could kind of float if you wanted to.
Yeah.
You could focus on art. You could focus on whatever you thought you needed to do with your life. And we, now working as much as we are, obviously, you don't get a chance to find that person inside, you know, not to sound all snowflakey, but come on, you're here on this planet for a fucking reason, and it's not to feed the machine, it's to be a goddamn human being, and to learn how to be a proper human being, and to care and respect other human beings. Hopefully, you come to that conclusion in the process.
Yeah. And, you know, you think of the irony of the people who, I think, believe in the old myths, who don't want to question them, and are then always furiously angry all the time.
Right.
But these are the people who are doing the right things and they have all the answers, but they're the ones who are, in so many cases, the truly furious.
Right.
And that's such a weird contradiction.
Huh.
And is it there deep down, you know, not to go full of Zizek for a minute, but is it there deep down cognitive dissonance? That right-wing rage, you think, I mean, Trump won...
Well,
Republicans got Congress, and there was white wing,
it's tough to say.
Freudian slip.
Yeah.
Right wing rage.
Right.
Immediate. But, like, we want everything. Fuck this country. You know, and it was like, you know, it's.
But to me, is where the myth of exceptionalism still rests in the worst possible way, because, you know, especially with boomers, and I'm sorry, I don't mean to point a generation out particularly.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of them either, so we can rip on boomers. Yeah. We can do a whole bad boomer podcast.
You have a generation of people who were told that they were exceptional and that they were great, and that they still continue to do it, and now they've gotten to a point in time in their life that they can't retire, that the ends aren't meeting, that they still haven't gotten to any place better. And they're pissed about it. America did not work for them. They bought into a lie. And when the lie didn't pay off, they built the system in a completely antithetical way to what the rest of the country wanted.
Yeah.
By and large. And again, that's just painting with a broad brush to some extent. It's not boomers.
And you know, and I think the other thing is, too, so a friend of mine, this happened because the magic of Facebook. Facebook, mm-hmm. It's so wonderful. A friend posted, there was a place that was a roadside stand, roadside produce stand on 22, and they had posted a thing on the, like, business page that PennDOT was angry because they had put out, you know, plywood signs by the side of the road, and they weren't necessarily up to code, and they weren't on the other side of the berm, and all of these things, and it was weird because it was a post from last year. And my friend had saw it, and it just kind of reposted it and without comment. And it was amazing to me. You never look at the comments.
Right.
But I looked at the comments. I broke my own rule. How every comment was in one way or another about race. Like, I mean, it was literally, these were talking about homemade plywood signs on the side of Route 22.
In an area that is almost exclusively white.
Yes. And in one way or another, the public debate was somehow about non-white people as a problem.
Yeah.
And that non-white people had somehow caused this problem, or was your revenge for employing non-white people, or whatever. And it was, like, so bizarre. I was like, this was surreal. And I was like, what does this have to do with PennDOT?
But this is another consistent problem now that spans generations.
Yeah.
It's not just a baby boomer thing. It's, this is wrong. It's not my fault. It's your fault.
Yes.
You know, and it's consistently passing it off to somebody else. You know, Trump has now done this 6 times this week, roughly, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The Russia thing. That's Obama's fault. You know, this is Hillary's fault. This isn't, you know, and you keep passing the buck instead of someone finally going, all right, shit. Sorry, my bad. You know,
let's fix this now.
Yeah. And we can't keep passing the buck. And you know, it's those areas kind of boggle my mind. The people that are most afraid of people of color are the people who never see a person of color.
Yeah,
which is part of the problem. You know.
Yeah. And it's weird. And I think too, it goes to this question of this difference between love and infatuation too. Mm-hmm. Also thinking about countries and where we live and how we think and whatever, you know, you love someone, you understand they're fucked up, you know, and you still love them. And I think in some ways there is this radical attempt to just total infatuation, and we can't think anything about anything else.
No, you know, this is, patriotism requires unconditional love. And if you break that unconditional love, then you're not patriotic.
Yeah.
Question mark.
Or unconditional infatuation.
Yeah.
I would argue. You know? Yeah. And so it's like going back to this, the value of these poems and the value of, you know, there was that reading at, was it Honey Tupelo Tees?
Oh, Tupelo Honey, yeah.
Tupelo Honey Tees a week or two ago with a bunch of great people. You were one of them.
Yes.
And thinking about, like, Nathaniel Williams Salty, Julio, I bought all their books and read them all this week. Ben something. I don't know, there's people.
Ben Brandeis, yes.
Ben Brandeis.
It was Jenny Skeleton, Misty Barca.
They never made it.
No, they showed up late and read.
Oh, we left!
Yeah. They showed up. And we weren't done. And they asked if we could turn on the PA, and I was like, yeah. I checked with Steph, and she was fine with it.
Damn.
So they read as well. So you got an encore. It, you know, it might have been the you know, past the proper time for the encore, because, you know, when you're sitting there waiting for the band and they take longer than 5 minutes, you're just like, I didn't want this encore all of a sudden. But no, that was an encore that was well worth it. But yeah, Ben Brandeis, Damian Rucci from Jersey, Nathaniel William Stolte, all those Buffalo people are part of the Cringeworthy Press crew, and they're doing really good things in Buffalo.
They are doing really good things, and you know, it was the thing, actually, Danelle said it, you know, when she laughed, she's like, this is this great kind of American working class poetry, this reclamation of this narrative from the sort of Springsteen jingoism or whatever to actual people and actual lives, their actual experiences and their actual struggles, and yeah, social history. 100 years from now, hopefully these poetry books will be around.
You want a poem about that now?
Yeah, sure, let's do it.
Okay.
Be it.
Cousin's Bar. It could happen on any night in America. That moment when poets take over the bar. The Garth Brooks jukebox dies slowly to the full barrel of laughter, to the explosion of light that words through the eyes of humans make. We res red solo shots to our memories, to our friends, to the improbability of here, to the humidity of a summer night in a borough not in the city, surrounded by the city. We dream out loud in color tonight. Julio in the doorway scribbles as much stardust out of his pen into a journal. Misty and Jenny dance with their shoulders to the talking heads. Rucci, already famous, rides his 5-year-old rejection letter from Reading Rainbow. Gijic, Calden, and the Paychecks, white people dance to Springsteen. Working class joy. It's Friday. We are free. It's every day, and maybe we don't know it, but we are free. When the bar lights cash out, Dr. Wu plays, and somehow it's moments lost on sidewalks, lost to time. We cross rivers that we see every day of our lives. They glow ethereal, not because we're drunk, but because somehow we're seeing them for the first time. The same with the quarter wedge moon, the same with Penn Avenue. Oh, the sway, the sway. This way. Rucci and I talk psychedelics and words we found under women's tongues till 3 a.m. And I give him a gift for his greyhound. We sleep ageless now. We are light and we are ageless now again.
Nice.
Thank you.
Nice. Oh.
Moments.
Yeah, moments.
Moments to time.
Moments to time, but this is what our lives are made of.
Yeah.
You know, and
that's why as a poet, you can write a poem every day if you try really hard. There's always some little thing that sparks, and, you know, life is just stringing those moments. I was talking just out the side of my mouth the other night to Collins, and I said, maybe we all write so we lose less, you know? Because yeah. You're constantly trying to retain all the things that are happening around you, you know. And I know supposedly your brain records everything and every moment is in you. I've heard that.
I've heard that too, yeah.
But I can't always access those moments.
No, I can't access it either.
The older I get, the you know, the weirder the time and space and memory get. But, you know, yeah. Can't always count on it to be what you think it is. So,
I mean, I think for me, it's also, I don't know, not that I've gotten, well, okay, you said about getting your poems out there. Well, you know, I just handed you a binder with poems. Some of them are 20 years old.
That's true.
That no one else has ever seen, pretty much. Like, 10 people have seen them. You're, like, number 11. But for me, it's also these moments where maybe I have a kind of moment of cognitive dissonance.
Mm-hmm.
Where there's some sort of, you know, fault line in our culture that needs to be resolved.
Okay.
You know, and I wonder about that in terms of your, you know, what makes something a story question. You know, because there's that back part of that. If you could tell it as a story, it could become a poem.
Right.
You know, well, what makes something a story? What makes something noteworthy enough? And for me, I think it is. It's like whenever I realize that there is some sort of tension, some sort of fault line. It goes back to that line in Oryx and Crake for me, where it's towards the end of the novel and the snowman is trying to do what he can
mm-hmm.
as things aren't going very well for him, to make sure that the Krakers live.
Okay.
This being of, like, sort of humanoid, superhuman entities that don't have human problems. And Krake, the genetic engineer who made these people-type things, I guess you can call them people, said to him once, you know, when they start making art, you know it's over. And they had made an object of art,
right,
in a moment of crisis.
Uh-huh.
And he went, shit, you know, and that line, you know, from this purely scientific, technical, the world should be efficient, these beings are efficient, when they start making art, you know the world's over. And I keep thinking about that in terms of thinking about storytelling as also exposing these fault lines.
Well, I mean, you're trying, you know, in one way you're trying to expose tropes and be a voice that isn't the voice that you're hearing out there. And just in another, it's a condition of memory and trying to find a way to get all these things that are happening around you all the time. But simultaneously, it's just with the world as beautiful as it is, not with people as beautiful. I mean, people can be beautiful.
People can be beautiful.
But the world itself and the improbability of your existence on this planet, I mean, that's pretty, that's exceptional. That means every day is a fucking story to some extent, right?
Yeah.
You know, or should be. And maybe that's part of the problem, is that we're not looking at these things in that way, that every day is this chance to do something interesting or to take your life further and to grow as a human, instead of just accepting a concept of heaven, perhaps,
or Netflix,
or afterlife, or Netflix, because that's pretty much what heaven is, right, nowadays for people.
Yeah,
you know, so I don't have to leave my house. It's pajamas and microwave dinners, and you know,
slow death.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean,
buried alive above ground, Netflix.
Yeah, that sounds about right. But I mean, I, you know, for me, the last 6 or so months since I got back from the tour that I did in October, I've pretty much written nonstop.
You are locked in. You are.
There's a moment, and I appreciate that. You get the work out there and let people tell you what the work does. I don't fucking know. I hope it does something. It certainly hits me. It feels like it needs to be said, so hopefully it resonates with somebody else. But, you know, I've finished, you know, the book that's coming out in September, and that little book, and I have a book that's ready and will be out hopefully next year, all about, you know, a friend of mine who passed away from cancer, and, you know, I have almost another full book on top of that, so I'm writing consistently, and it's just, you know, the more you look for these things, the more you try and isolate those moments, like you do in like I've done in Fumble's Revelations, hopefully, you find those moments easier then, and that they come faster and faster, and then all of a sudden, you're kind of overwhelmed consistently, because the world becomes more than you can possibly handle. You know, the sensory overload of just being is massive sometimes.
Yeah, no, I get that. And I think being and being aware, and you know, reminds me of an article in the Chronicle of Higher Ed that I read in maybe 2008-2009 about GM workers in Michigan, and was when they were shutting down one of the, it was part of the sort of auto bailout kind of that era. They were shutting down an SUV plant. And in Michigan, and the workers there had three options. One was you just took a cash buyout, you know, cash severance, there you go. Two, you could move to near Lordstown, Ohio, and make Chevy Cruises. Or three, you could be wherever you were, but you got a free associate's degree. And this was a huge part of the Obama higher ed policy, which is why I was in the Chronicle, and this was maybe a test litmus case. You know, and of course what? I mean, a lot of people, they had spouses who worked, so a lot of people took the buyout. Some people moved to Ohio and built cruises. And then a minority of folks did the community college thing. And of those, not a lot made it through. And it was this question of thinking, well, if this is community college and it's supposed to serve this function for being open access, open enrollment, education, for everyone. Mm-hmm. And yet all of these people offering, even in the face of a free associate's degree, it didn't work for them. And they talked about a lot of the reasons why, you know, was external financial pressures and all of that. And they talked to one guy who was on his way, and he had actually gotten his associates and then had transferred and was working on a bachelor's. And they were asking the guy in the interview, he's like, why did you make it and others didn't? And he said, you have to realize something. All of us, some of these people have been on that line for 30 years in an environment where thinking and feeling only means pain.
Right.
And you then suddenly put them in an environment where they're expected to think and feel.
And that becomes, you know...
And that becomes a real kind of culture shock, and that becomes maybe an opening of wounds, and that becomes... And I'm thinking about how also for so many people, and I'm thinking about maybe what poetry can do for reclaiming the national narrative or whatever, for people for whom thinking and feeling really fucking hurts.
And for most people, you're... Yeah, well, there's a great Robert Mitchum line in Out of the Past, where he's in the bar in Mexico and he just meets Kathy Moffat, who was Jane. Anyway, doesn't matter. And she says something to him, and he's like, "If I sit alone, I just think, and I'm too old to start that now." You know. Anyway, there's a long way around to get there, but you get what I mean.
Yeah.
We don't encourage pushing yourself at this point in time, and it's hard to do. I mean,
it is hard to do, and again, some of that shit hurts, man.
Some, you're banging up against places and hitting things in yourself that are uncomfortable, and you just have to accept that sometimes you open a wound, but it makes the next 10 steps so much easier once you've opened it. I'll read a poem in a second. Have you ever read Ben Hamper's Rivethead?
Yes, that is a fantastic, wonderful, lovely, amazing book.
Yeah.
Love that book to death.
That's a... I highly recommend that to the entire audience.
Yes, hopefully that's still in print. I wonder if that's still in print.
I find it every now and again, and whenever I do, I Scott Silsby it. I buy it, and I hand it to somebody.
Nice.
I think it's an important book.
It is an important book.
And at the end of the Industrial Revolution... You know, Hamper kind of was seeing what was going on 25 years before anybody else was.
Yeah. And just real quick for everybody's synopsis, he from the late 70s to mid 80s worked on the GMC Suburban Chevy Blazer line.
In Flint, Michigan.
In Flint, Michigan. Yes. And then towards the end of his life, he worked at the Pontiac plant, I think in Pontiac, Michigan. Or not the end of his life, in the end of his career as an auto worker, and just these tales of what it was like to be an assembly line auto worker. Mm-hmm. And it is hilarious and real, and the sort of weird assaults on human dignity that assembly line work had. I mean, he turns them into comedy gold, but I mean, there's, I think, a real message there in terms of what working life is like for many, many, many people.
Yes, I think I can agree with that. I can't remember if I read that before or after Studs Terkel. The writing of Studs Terkel Blues, which I should read a poem from, but I'll read that later.
Okay.
I got a poem queued up here in my hand.
Poem queued up here, yeah.
Which fits what we're talking about. I was going to pontificate about Hamper a little bit, but I can't place what I was going to say. Also. So this is a poem called Resume, which, as being unemployed currently, I was supposed to be writing my resume with a friend one night, and we couldn't make that happen, so instead I wrote a poem that would be what you could say if you were allowed to say what you wanted to at an interview, etc., or in on a resume cover letter. Dear human resource manager, I know you get millions of pieces of paper from job-hungry applicants that don't give a fuck about you as much as... you don't give a fuck about us as much as we don't give a fuck about you. There we go. Jesus Christ. But capitalism still hasn't ended. I mean, theoretically, it ended when the Industrial Revolution was pronounced dead. But capitalism's endless exploitation is still rampant. And apparently just to live, just to experience life, is not an acceptable trade. I suppose it doesn't matter that this is not meaningful work. there are only mostly retail and service jobs left for low-wage workers who could be so lucky to dream about universal basic income, or for that fact, free fucking healthcare. So I will happily wait on Americans who somehow believe that these material possessions will somehow fill the emptiness in their hearts. I can't tell you what intangible qualities I have. I am quick with new tasks. I've run businesses for friends that were dying of cancer. I do work hard when there's work to be done. I think outside the box. I like to write poems and daydream. I want to cry at least once a day because the world is beautiful. Because the world is sad, because I might be hungover, because existence is ultimately futile. I can't tell you I won't spend more than 2 hours a day in the bathroom writing poems on paper or on stall walls. If I choose the stall walls, I can promise you will have the most articulate customers. I'll even be happy to hide a dictionary behind the toilet in case I get a pension to use one of those $5 words. I'll happily volunteer my Webster's that I stole in 8th grade. It has space guns drawn on the margins, but it's served me well for almost 30 years. I have no idea where the hell I'll be in 5 years, or in 10 years. If any of us could see that far into the fucking future, we wouldn't be sitting here waiting on a goddamn job. Hell, I'm still not even sure what I want to be when I grow up. Or maybe I know, but people don't pay poets money. People don't believe in art. People only seem to believe in money and a god that doesn't exist. They long for an afterlife like I long for early retirement, and Jesus, I promise I won't say that out loud again. I think it's safe to say that I'm highly adaptable. Last week I installed cabinets one day, then I hung a suspended ceiling the next. I sold records for friends in my spare times. I wrote and submitted poems and I agreed to do another benefit show. Then I woke up and I was a book mule. I drank beer on my break because it tasted good. And I was tired and it was offered, and I learned a long time ago you should always say no in moderation. Seriously though, I sold paint to people. I've been cursed out for not having the key to a narcotics locker when I managed a drugstore. I pretended to care about office supplies, sporting goods, deli meat, detailing cars, processing checks, auto parts, and that doesn't even count all the things that I may have pretended to care about because I needed a job then as I need a job now. I will ask that if you care to drug test, I will pass so long as you don't test for marijuana. I know it's still sort of illegal. I promise I won't smoke it before a shift or in the middle of a shift, but I do enjoy it socially, and generally, it's the only way I get a good night's sleep nowadays. And that is important for productivity. And that's what you want, right? Happy and productive workers, anesthetized and dreamless, wading through their lives, just getting by, constantly careening at the drop edge of broke, a paycheck away from being hungry, a paycheck away from being homeless, a paycheck away from hope.
That should handle the Ben Hamper thing pretty well.
Yeah, no, that handles the Ben Hamper thing pretty well, and just put your beer down on a shelf, and the shelf above it is the works of Zygmunt Bauman.
I'm not familiar with Bauman.
Bauman, a very...
You see Liquid Fear and Consuming Life, The Art of Life. Is Bauman one of these, like, Eric Frohman kind of guys?
You know, he really is. He really
is. Like the modern version of Frohman?
Modern version died just this year, actually. Okay. You know, his life story in a nutshell, Polish Jew born in 1925.
Okay.
Yeah, so September 1st, 1939, kind of rough day, was a member of the underground resistance, got out and went to England, came back, got kicked out by the communists in the 70s, and as a refugee, you know, had these experiences, and it made him think kind of socially in different ways, and then started realizing by the late 90s, I think he had this kind of modest but okay career as an academic and a writer. Okay. And sometime around 93, 92, 93, some kind of switch got flipped in him, man. And until he died, I mean, he was putting out multiple books a year and okay. is somebody who I think is essential in understanding how people are really fucked up today. And I think for him, I think he had these experiences as a refugee. He had this experience, I mean, he literally, they were like, we won't kill you, but you have to leave and you have to surrender your passport. We will give you travel papers and you can go and let's see who takes you.
Okay.
And in a lot of ways, he felt like he saw echoes 20 years later after neoliberalism took over and people's emotional lives and intimate understandings of themselves that he kind of experienced as a refugee.
It wouldn't surprise me.
And he talks about the idea of the precariat.
Okay.
And the root of that word goes back to is a French word, the idea of the people who stand on the shifting sands. And how, for all of us alive at this moment in history, which he calls liquid modernity, we are all in this constantly fluid, constantly flowing stream. And to stay still or find a restful spot is a kind of death.
Mm-hmm.
And so we must always be remaking ourselves and always must be remaking our identities to fit into this large stream. And he says, you know, in that sense, we are all kind of really fucked up by this,
right?
Is his thing. And that what does that do to an entire planet, at least a first world people or I guess global north people, mm-hmm. is the term now, who for whom the ability to stand still or to be secure, you know. And he says our lives and our culture, if you go back how many human generations, you know, how many people were born and died within 50 miles of the same spot,
right?
And he said, you know, in a different era he would have been born and gone to a synagogue and met somebody in that synagogue and married and raised children and went to that synagogue and brought the children up in that synagogue in that town, and then would have died, had a funeral mass in that or whatever in the synagogue, and then been buried, and that just would have been it.
Right.
And in that way, he said, you know, granted, you think even under that social arrangement where there are strict rules on what you should be,
mm-hmm.
how many people struggle to follow the rules,
right.
and their lives don't fit that narrative. He said now, as people, for the first time in history, the mass quantity of humans, not only do we have to struggle to fit into the rules of being something, but we have to figure out whatever the fuck that thing is.
Right.
And that is an extra move that humanity hasn't had to try to make before. And all, basically, all of his narratives in a certain way or another, or all of his books are in a way or another, are explorations of that kind of contemporary crazy that we're living under.
Well, that makes sense.
As the precariat.
That's well, if you live in a world that is constantly technologically changing, faster than evolution can keep up,
yeah,
you're already on the downside of it. You know,
yeah.
Nobody understands where we're headed, and things are moving faster than we can even process. So you've already got sort of a PTSD is the wrong word to use in this occasion, but it's a similar sort of thing,
and it's a similar sort of kind of chronic anxiety.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I think of the young people that I work with, you know, who are just about to try to merge onto that expressway for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
The absolute human wreckage, you know. It's not, damn millennials, but millennials are damned. You know, I mean, really, it's all gone.
Everything is arguing with me over here.
It's all gone wrong.
It's all right.
Stuff's falling.
It's fine.
Everything's been fixed. French movie posters.
French movie posters happen sometimes.
Yeah, they do.
There's nothing wrong with it.
No, but... And I think, and again, maybe is that a moment where just claiming or reclaiming the fact that your own story, your own moments, this writing so that we don't lose thing that you mentioned before. I see I'm quoting you again. Now you can quote me quoting you forever.
We can be in a meta push and pull here.
We can be in a meta push and pull, the stream of liquid modernity that we're in.
But that also ultimately makes writing at this time in history even more important, because you're trying to maintain some sort of identity. And think about how much the world has changed since you were a kid. I mean, neither one of us were brought up with the internet. That was a high school thing. And this, I know, this is where you start to roll into the I sound like an old man thing. But, you know, we've adapted to these things, and now you have people that have never not been on the internet.
Yeah.
You know, their entire lives are documented as such.
You know what? Hey, listen, this'll fuck you up. My freshmen this fall will barely, if they remember 9/11...
That's true.
Too young to remember 9/11.
Yeah, there was a... I was reading an article on a baseball site about prospects, and this was the first draft that 2000 are the youngest players are coming,
yeah.
You know, in. So you just started high school, you know, you were born in 2000, and now you're graduating high school. This is kind of mind-boggling in that regard.
It is, it is. I mean, it's funny, you know, when I had a moment with a young man this spring semester where I said, you know, your formative years were the great American freakout.
Mm-hmm.
And he came up to me afterwards, like, I never really heard them called that, but that makes so much sense.
It's a freakout. It's this...
long emergency.
Long emergency that is rapidly... it was fascism before we ever recognized it as fascism, and to even stand here now and say, oh, Trump is the, you know, is fascism, is missing the point. Fascism started 2001, September 11th. And that shock doctrine that came after that led us to this place, and ultimately we are already in a fascist society. How you fix a fascist society at this point in time becomes the question that actually needs to be asked
and,
and dealt with. And that's where no political party is dealing with, and why fascism will continue to blossom, unfortunately, because you have no alternative to fascism. So, at least at this moment.
At this moment,
Hopefully between now and the midterm election, something comes up. But I don't know if we're going to move that fast.
I don't know if we're going to move that. I'd be happy for at least one of the houses of Congress flipping so we can put the brakes on.
Well,
it's... you know what I mean? Like, you put the brakes on and then at least... because that's the thing, right? I mean, the vote for Hillary Clinton was a vote for gridlock.
Yes.
Realizing, oh, it's just going to be gridlock. Yeah. Well,
you voted things for won't more get
better. Side. They'll just slowly decay.
Yeah. No, and that...
it'll be like something that's been unpainted and left out in the sun. Okay, you can still sit on that bench, but, you know, you can make it nicer. But...
well, freedom decays. Well, you know, the institution of America decays, whatever that institution ultimately means or meant over the course of 200
years. There's nobody dousing it in gasoline.
As yet. And I don't see anybody actually doing it. The, you know, I mean, the system has to unfortunately... fortunately, probably more so, be changed from the inside. You know, the way this whole thing is constructed, there's no other way to do it, which is why, swallow your pride, kids, go learn and vote, please.
You know? Yeah,
let's turn this motherfucker on its ear quickly.
Yeah.
You know, and if you're not finding the candidates, start demanding the candidates that you need.
And I think there's also something you said for community organizing.
Yes.
Well, and organizing within your community kind of immediately and maybe even around single issues in your community can be a radical infusion of democracy at a time when we need radical infusions of democracy.
Isn't that the ultimate answer to globalization is localizing?
Yeah.
You know, like... if globalization is the ultimate statement of what's happening, then what you need to do is understand that everything has to be done locally to fight globalism at that point in time.
Yeah. Or you could just watch a bunch of 24-hour news cable TV and get really pissed off and be dumb on the internet. That's working for a lot of people.
Well, you know... the expressway to your skull is open, man.
Sorry.
And there's an immediate reaction.
We were getting hopeful, and I just, like, my cynical virus.
No,
like,
no, no.
Gene just said, no, that's hopeful. That's almost hopeful. You're giving people a way out.
As a Gen Xer, I have to consistently fight against my own cynicism. You know?
No, is that fucked up?
Yeah, it's a thing. I understand, you know. You can give millennials hell for whatever you want to give millennials hell for, but you can give me hell for being consistently fucking cynical. So.
Yeah, I'm with you, man.
I'm hopeful and cynical all in the same boat, so I'm probably the worst. I'm a romantic at heart. And there's no place for a romantic in these fucking worlds.
That's right. You got another poem for us?
Yeah, let's do The Ballad of $9.63. This is from the Studs Terkel Blues, which came out in 2014 on Night Ballet Press. That's run by Diane Borsnick. She's in El Rio, Ohio. And she does a lot of really great books, so check her out.
There'll be a link on the podcast.
Yes, sir. The Ballad of $9.63. I was looking for work in factories. Because I was young. Because I was smarter than the people who pissed me off with their endless stupidity. Because I was tired of working retail. Because it paid better than retail. Because you didn't need to deal with fucking customers. Because my mother already needs help with the bills. Because I already don't work for a paycheck. I work to give my money away. I took a job overnight, a factory outside of Newcastle, 11 to 7. And in the morning, 11 to 7, Sunday through Thursday. Started off drying bathtub molds for $8.50 an hour. We had to make 50 to 100 bathtubs a night. I was the first step, workbench and chamois drying down these big hulking molds as they rocked and danced on the hook on metal ball bearing. The line was constantly down. I'd dry 10 molds, then stop for an hour, sit outside, work a pack of cigarettes, sit on the grass, watch the moon, listen to men talk about cars and the girls they were gonna fuck. When it got colder, I'd sit on boxes and close my eyes, pretend I wasn't asleep, try not to look at my watch and realize it was only 4 a.m., and then 7 after 4, and then 12 after 4, and then still not 6 a.m. or 7 a.m. or whatever fucking time it needed to be for me to be numb and drive the 40 minutes home, trying like hell not to fall asleep at the wheel. I got promoted to roller. Somebody else was in charge of the chamois now. I got a wire paint roller that I kept in a locker, a mask to keep fiberglass out of my lungs. And when the line wasn't down and the guy ahead of me decided he was going to spray molds, me and another guy went over the molds, our rollers, ensuring that no air bubbles would wreck the integrity of these fine fiberglass behemoths. The promotion came with a raise, $9.63 an hour, with only 6 weeks till I was inducted into the union. Every night I'd roll out air bubbles, dream of sunrise over Lake Arthur as I drove home. I'd think of my girlfriend and how I could smell her in my respirator through the fiberglass stink. In the morning I'd race home, changing out of the same clothes I wore every night, the ones that were black and stiff with chemical compounds. I'd peel bits of fiberglass off my own skin as I drove and throw them out the window. Seedling helicopters, Grace and the Wake, pushing me along as I tried for all the hell to stay awake.
Nice.
Yes, when factory jobs still existed and you could get paid slightly above minimum wage. I mean, what? That was 1996, and I was making $10 an hour.
Wow, that's almost double minimum wage back in those days.
That was double minimum wage.
5 1/4 back in those days, wasn't it?
And it has taken me 20 years to make more than $10 an hour.
Mm. Adjusted for inflation, though.
Adjusted for inflation, I got screwed.
Yeah. All right.
We all did.
And at that moment...
Where are we at?
We're about an hour and 2 minutes.
Oh, okay.
So I think it might be time for the bottom five.
Okay, we can bottom five this.
Yeah, five, you know, be personable, be, how can I say this? Gentle to our audience. Gentle to our audience. We don't want to go 2 hours. But Neil will be back in September, I'm sure. If we not always, before then.
We always go over somehow.
Yes, we know? Always do. So now it's time for the bottom five. Bottom five is a series of questions not related to our main topic that are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature. Are you ready, Jason Baldinger, for the bottom five?
Yes, but don't let me forget after I answer this that I got to plug the Bridge series.
You do have to plug. We got to plug the Bridge series. We got to plug 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 books. We got to plug your book release show on Friday night, Friday, June 30th.
You got it.
Last day of the fiscal year, you know.
We're going to bring America crashing down that night. Yes.
There we go. So we got all that.
Okay, cool. I just wanted to make sure I didn't forget anything.
I wrote it down.
Okay, cool. You've got notes. I don't have notes.
I got notes. I got notes.
I'm sitting here like on the tightwire, brother.
I got notes. I got a red music stand. And I got clothespins. We don't worry. Your captain is speaking. And we are at a comfortable cruising speed.
Thank God no turbulence. Mark Farner is here.
All right, question number one, and I went back to the old shows.
To make sure that we weren't duplicating.
We weren't duplicating, okay. So question one. What is the strangest injury you have ever suffered?
There's a poem about that.
Is it handy? Is it real? Is it is it in Studs Terkel Blues?
It is in Studs Terkel Blues.
Well, there we go. Is this the best? He's just reading it in a poem. He's just going to read it in the poem, folks.
All right. Here's your answer. It comes in the form of a poem. This is the hymn to Toilet Duck. We got 2 to 4 trucks a night, 48 to 53 feet trailers, dangerous mazes, boxed merchandise, wobbly castles, precarious towers stacked threatening to fall down. It was not unusual to grab a box and 10 more follow it, free of gravity, or to have a box ride along with another, both careening straight at you. This particular humid night, soaked through skin in an all-day baked metal box, I lift a box of paper towels from above my head. I bring it down and a hidden box falls. I have no escape. Gravity is as gravity does. I should throw my hands up, but I blew the ligaments in my wrist last fall to avoid a broken jaw in a similar scenario. The subterfuge box, Toilet Duck, if memory serves, scores a direct hit to my temple. And I'm winded. I'm fading. I stagger back and I hit the wall and bounce. My perception spirals. The room swings left and the room swings right. Everything dims and I fold on the floor, dazed. My manager next down the line stops and asks if I'm all right. And I say, I don't know. Give me a minute. I take a minute. And I slowly get up and start back to work, ginger on unsure feet. Everything sounds underwater. Everything swims. Everything belongs to a fickle reality. I finish the truck, shades of pale, and keep working till 6. Nauseous, I ask to leave early. I warn the manager that I may have a concussion, but he doesn't insist on a hospital. He sends me home. I drive home with non-existent reaction times. Stop signs walk away from me. I get lost on side streets that I've driven 1,000 times. I pull into the driveway and I can't remember how I got home. I leave the keys in the car and can't find them when I try and unlock the front door. I leave a note to be woken up, to have someone ask me pertinent questions before I crawl into bed. I know I'm not supposed to sleep. I'm so tired. I wake up and I can answer questions, and then I go back to sleep. 12 hours later, I make it to a hospital. Dizzy and confused, I stop at work to get paperwork so the worker's comp pays off. The manager on duty says, poor boy, and then she rubs my head. There has to be an easier way to get a day off.
Oh, Toilet Duck.
A concussion by Toilet Duck.
Concussion by Toilet Duck.
That is a strange injury.
That's the best I can do for you.
No, that's great. Oh, my God. I mean, not great that happened to you, but that's a great poem and a great way to answer a question.
I can try and answer each question with a poem, maybe.
You could.
Well, I don't know if it's going to work.
All right, question two. Out of the people who have seen you naked, how many? And you just actually, this is just a number, really. I'm looking for. Out of the people who have seen you naked, how many do you never want to speak to ever again?
Oh, shit.
Mental tally time. Includes any awkward high school gym class bullshit too.
We didn't have to do that. I went to Catholic school. It was very repressed.
Yeah.
Two maybe.
All right. That means either you have lived or you haven't lived. I don't know. Question three.
It means I'm very forgiving.
Yeah. That means. There you go.
Or somebody else has to be, hopefully.
Yes. There you go. Question three. Have you ever had a dream you wish you could revisit, or a dream world you wish you could periodically visit from time to time? Alternate dream reality that you wish you could kind of go on vacation in, I guess is what I'm asking here.
Alternate dream world? No. Just, you know, put me on the road, and it's an alternate dream world in its own right. You know, I've said that travel and driving the American highways, at least for any extended period of time, is like taking acid every day. You know, so you do 70 days on a road, you're gonna find your mind completely blown and in a completely different reality at the same point in time than anybody else's.
Like it.
Okay.
Awesome, yeah. Question four, then. Question four. Props if you can come up with a poem for this one. What's the strangest item you ever have ever eaten and or found in your stool? I'll take found in your stool. But what's the strangest item ever processed by your digestive system?
Oh, I don't know. That's a tough one.
This includes things you could have accidentally swallowed.
Yeah, I try and be very cognizant about what I eat, although I'm not picky.
Yeah.
By any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, so this could just be the sort of cuisine exotica question, too.
Unfortunately, I never find the restaurants with the weirdest of food. I mean, I think maybe, like, the strangest thing that I may have eaten would be, like, alligator.
Ooh, you've had alligator.
I have had alligator, which tastes like chicken. doesn't everything. Frog legs never entertained me. I've been curious about rattlesnake, but I've never found a restaurant that served it. I've eaten elk. Yeah, but nothing I think that was terribly strange. I know there are places in West Virginia that serve possum burgers, and I've tried to find them, but I've never actually located one.
Muskrat?
I've never eaten muskrat.
Sorry, Scott.
Yeah, I've seen a muskrat or two along the way.
I've seen muskrats, but yeah.
Yeah. I guess alligator is the strangest meat product that I've eaten. That's
fair enough.
I have a penchant for chewing on garlic chives while I hike whenever they're up. Nice. You know, so nice. Occasionally maybe eating a May apple, which you probably shouldn't eat, but, you know.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Whatever.
So, no, it's fairly pedestrian.
I like it. That's all right. That's cool. Question five. And this actually maybe loops back to our pre-podcast conversation. Sorry. What is one pop culture text or personal preference you wish more people did or knew about?
Wow.
If there was one thing that's in your life that's in your wheelhouse. Because that's another thing about the moment that we're living in. Is that culture... At least for some of us. I mean, yes, people live in the boring Netflix world. Is just the monolith. But then there's all this intimate culture and all this intimate, like, I know about this record, this poet, this thing that means so much and is defining this era in my life and your life and whatever. And it's just like, it's a weird thing, right? There's not really a meta-narrative anymore in that sense. So is there one thing... in all of that that you wish more people knew about or did?
Whew. That's such a broad question.
That is a broad motherfucking question.
I don't know what to really do with that.
Because, I mean, we had this conversation before the podcast started about working in a record store and how everybody just knows about the records and everybody wants to talk to you about the records. And that's one way to go. Or is it something sort of literary everybody should be reading? Yeah, that's meta. This is choice theory in a nutshell, right? That one of the core premises of choice theory research is if you give someone too many choices, they get paralyzed.
And that does happen.
I think it's happening to you right now.
It really is. I mean, like, there are movies that I think are absolutely essential to seeing or understanding the world, and movies like, you know, Renoir's Grand Illusion or Agnes Varda's Cleo from 5 to 7 or Fellini's 8 and a Half, which I think, funny actually, that I read in Dayton, Ohio, and I read a poem about Fellini and Cleveland and a bunch of other things. And just, you could see the references, you know, as I was, you know, speaking, just going straight through these people, you know.
Oh.
So, you know, movie-wise,
that sounds good. That's a good place to start.
Music-wise, Charles Mingus.
Okay.
Charles Mingus, all the way across the board. More people need to have Charles Mingus in their head as the soundtrack to the world. Book-wise, that's an incredibly difficult question. But probably something like The People's History of the United States would be the most important thing to this exact moment in history. If you have not tried to challenge the history that you were taught, you need to do that. You need to understand that the history that you were given out of a textbook is a rich fucker's history. Yeah. It's not. It's the, you know, to the victor go the spoils.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas how we need to think about our history is, you know, more in the, and I don't like to quote Thomas Jefferson often, but each generation remakes democracy in its image, and
yeah,
that there needs to be some split in between those concepts. So Zinn's People's History of the United States might be the most important thing. Other than that, I don't know what else I could throw at you. You know?
I think that's a pretty good list. I think that's a great great homework assignment for our loyal listeners, or our casual listeners, or whatever, whoever the hell accidentally clicks on this.
Yeah, whoever accidentally clicks on this.
Or, like, I know Jason. I heard he was on a podcast or something. Yeah, there we go.
So, yeah.
I think that's about it.
That's about it.
And so we got some things to plug.
Okay, we
got
to talk about if you're free tomorrow night.
Tomorrow night, and by tomorrow night, we mean...
Wednesday, that's right.
Wednesday, June 28th, since this is probably going on the internet around 11 o'clock on Tuesday, June 27th.
Right.
So if you're listening to this at work, Wednesday, June 28th, then you should go to the Brillo Box on Penn Avenue near Children's Hospital in Bloomfield for...
The Bridge Series, which is a monthly reading series trying to meld activists and writers together. Tomorrow night, our feature organization will be the Greater Pittsburgh Literacy Council, so donations will go to them. It's a $5 cover, but you can always give more. Our readers will include Paolo Corso, Nancy Krigowski, and Robert Yoon. Nice. The Bridge has its own Facebook page nowadays, and email address and whatnot. I think this is our fifth month, and we'll be running through November, and then in December we do the Labor ACLU reading that we always do. So something last Wednesday of the month you can always find. At the Brillo Box, we will be reading poems and other such things, and it's, you know, trying.
It's always a good time.
Yeah,
it's always good time, good cause.
And yeah, the readings have been fantastic.
Yes, they have. I missed one because I got sick.
Yeah,
and I was a bad boy. But
no, I mean,
I'll be there. You can meet me.
Yeah, you can meet us both.
Yeah, absolutely.
So there's that Friday night. At
On Butler Street in Lawrenceville.
Yeah, Butler and 50 something.
Yeah. 50 there'll be a link on the website. Yeah. There'll be a link on the website to the Facebook thing, and I'll probably spell out the address for both events.
Yes.
On the website so people can GPS it.
Are you saying this so you remember to do it yourself?
I'll forget. I might forget, but I tend to try to do that.
Yes.
So I'm making a promise. It might be broken. It might not. We'll see.
Yeah.
I guess go to goodadiepodcast.com and find out.
Find out for sure. Anyway, Fumbles Revelation book release is happening, and it will be myself and Don Wentworth, Jason Irwin, Becky Corrigan, and Red Bob, who used to work with me at the record store. We are also all cancers. I put the reading together as such. Put that any way you like. I mean, I don't put much faith in astrology, but I thought it was an entertaining way to book a bill.
Absolutely.
So that is upcoming. Fumbles Revelation is available through Grackle and Crow. I don't know that they have a website that it's for sale, but
well,
it is for sale.
For it.
Locally at Nine Stories, White Whale, City of Asylum, Caliban, and if you happen to be in Cleveland at Maxbax Books, you can also shoot me an email, and I have PayPal, and we can work shit out that way. Yeah, was there something else?
Oh, well, there's four other fine books. The Lady of Pittsburgh, Studs Terkel Blues, Whiskey Rebellion, and The Lower 48 that folks can... through that email that I'll make sure I'll get
to you. Yeah, you can email me and we can talk and I can get stuff. That's on Speed and Briscoe.
Speed and Briscoe.
Studs Terkel's on Night Ballet. That's on Whiskey Rebellion's on Sixth Gallery, as is The Lower 48.
Yes.
And Fragments of a Rainy Season will also be on Sixth Gallery when it comes out in September.
Fantastic. You'll be there before, I think, before in celebration of that. If not before, who knows?
Who Who knows what'll happen? And yeah, there will be
sometime in the 50s of this podcast.
Another book next year called The Afterlife is a Hangover.
Fantastic. And yeah, so that really is about it. Oh, one other thing I will say, there is a loyal listener or podcast, Ren, who's had has had a real family tragedy. And we just want to say we're thinking about you, buddy. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Our next episode will eventually happen, and it will be about something. Our homepage, where you can find new and old episodes, is gonnadiepodcast.com. I'll also post links to a bunch of the stuff that we talked about today. And of course, We're All Gonna Die is on Facebook and Twitter. At Gonna Die Podcast is the Twitter handle. We're also on iTunes. I'm saying this out of order. Thanks, as always. Later, meets.
Thanks, Matt.
You're welcome.